Well, today I want to introduce a walking wiki. He's been on this program before, spouting unlikely facts that turn out to be true. I call him a walking wiki because he's always asking, did you know this or that? And it's a gazillion to a lone sardine that you didn't. He's also a walker, trudging the ridges with a stout stick and sometimes in a kilt. The walking wiki is also called Peter MacInnis, and he has a new book about explorers. But he's also got a few unlikely facts. Let's start with those. Peter.
I learned a Leigh Hunt poem when I was young. It began, Jenny kissed me when we met, jumping from the chair she sat in. Jenny was Jane Carlyle. In June last year, I saw the chair she sat in, just inside the door of Jane and Thomas Carlyle's house in London's Chelsea. Then I admired the Chelsea Physic Garden before searching out a statue of William Huskisson MP, who died a few years before Hunt wrote his poem. Huskisson's statue is in a small park by the Thames, draped in a Roman toga. He died in 1830, the first man to be run down and killed by a train. It was only doing 30 miles an hour, but back then nobody understood such speeds. His death led indirectly to the fall of the Duke of Wellington's government, and under a new government, the passage of the first Reform Bill in 1832. Nobody could have predicted that steam railways might cause democratic reform, because science and technology rarely do the expected, but always cause the unexpected. Fritz Haber's process for fixing nitrogen was an agricultural breakthrough that later allowed Germany to keep producing munitions in World War I. The introduction of quinine beat malaria, but allowed Europeans to flourish in Africa to the detriment of the Africans. And Mr. Bell's telephone lines became the internet. Today, the internet and the computer tempt many to predict the death of the book as we know it. They say we will store text in digital form to carry around or download at whim to be searched, rummaged through, annotated, reordered, and generally treated in ways that wouldn't impress an old-fashioned book lover. Technology rarely does the obvious, but it always surprises us. I say the printed book is still kicking along and probably has a few more surprises for us. Then again, I would, because I've just published another book, and although I used a great deal of technology in creating it, my book appears fairly standard. I wanted to look at the ways Australian explorers worked, to examine and describe what they took with them, how they used it, what they ate and drank, what medical treatments they used, and I knew this information was in the journals that all the explorers kept, and most of them published, in the 1800s. I have a major gripe about the way new science gets into schools. Thomas Kuhn said it first, but I've adopted it. New science textbooks are written by regurgitating old science textbooks, with little reference to new finds or ideas. Most scientific advances take 30 years or more to be even noted. As a textbook writer and general science writer, I've always tried to go back to source, even when that made me read research that caused my brain to hurt. History suffers a similar problem. Histories written for a general or juvenile audience trot out the same threadbare recycled facts. The Blue Mountains were first crossed by three important white men, and at least half my listeners will already have thought Blaxland, Wentworth and Lawson, 1813. Most of them will also have recalled the furphy that these three had the bright and original idea of following the ridges. While the idea was bright, it was far from original. That lump of history came from people who weren't bushwalkers. Walkers know that even blind Freddy would follow the ridges. Sit back and look at any eminence, and your eye will be drawn up the easy and gentle rise along the ridges. The standard tale ignores the need for extra staff on any expedition. The famous three took servants, at least some of them convicts, on the trip, and my digging revealed that many standard explorers were also accompanied by teenagers, even teenage girls, women, Aborigines, convicts, and foreigners, none of them fitting the noble myth of the sterling British gentleman of breeding and character, so beloved of my school texts. There were well-bred British heroes, but that's only part of the story. Another part is the involuntary help offered by the Aborigines. I don't mean as in well-bred Englishman David Carnegie feeding old ladies salt pork, then tying them up in the ravages of thirst until they led the noble pom to water. I mean the generations of people who walked quietly through the bush and laid down what the explorers called native paths or native roads. Convicts found established Aboriginal tracks within a few days of landing at Sydney Cove when they walked to Botany Bay, where two French ships were at anchor, and asked for a passage out. By the way, if you've been taught that Australia was nearly French because La Perouse just missed out, when Lieutenant King saw the two ships, one with the Commodore's pennant, he knew right away both the names of the ships and the Commodore. La Perouse was no surprise to them. Anybody reading King's journal would know that. Many of the gems that I gathered, like that one, were in libraries like Sydney's Mitchell and Adelaide's Bar Smith, but the bulk of my material came from one brilliant source, Project Gutenberg, and in particular from the Australian arm of that organisation. Technology delivers what we need to get the full picture. I downloaded 5 million words of journals, all scanned, processed and proofed by volunteers. I culled to make a database of about 1 million words, 5,500 selected passages, each linked to the Explorer, a date, a source, and a set of keyword codes. Explorers often called crocodiles alligators or caimans, and some of them used curious spelling as well. I needed the keyword codes if I was ever going to find the themes. Keeping it brief, I took text with line breaks, used word processor macros to format this into paragraphs, used other macros to add extra fields to my chosen passages, separated by tabs. I exported them to a spreadsheet where more fields were added or calculated to allow sorts and searches. Later, I used a spreadsheet to generate the visual basic code to convert my keyword codes to plain English, and then put that code into a word processor macro before exporting the translated codes back to the spreadsheet. I also used the spreadsheet to generate an HTML version, a full-on database, and a word processor version. Then I could start writing. The 5 million words had shrunk to 1 million. Now they needed to be distilled to just 65,000, so I chose with care. Robin Williams once called me a fact fossicker, and it's a term I've always held on to. I do fossick. I take a small temporary obsession, like, say, compasses, and look through the text using the computer as a highly efficient shovel and rake. I find the patterns. That led me to Cater's compass, a form of prismatic compass, and revealed a curious history when I looked around to see who else had used one. The database grew from library searches. Then I discovered the Gregory compass. Commonly called the Gregory pattern compass, it's also seen as the Gregory patent compass. The word we pronounce patent should be patent, and there's no record of it ever being registered, so I suspect a small confusion occurred. It was greatly admired, but nobody now knows what it looked like. Inquiring into the animals used, I came across Mr. Horrocks, who was shot by his camel. Horrocks set out in 1846 with the painter S.T. Gill, Harry, the only camel on the continent, a cook named Garlic, an indigent sculptor, a herd of hyperactive goats, an emu-catching dog, and some other servants. Horrocks was after good farming land in South Australia, but like many explorers, he also collected scientific specimens. One day, he unloaded his double-barreled gun to reload with fine shot to take a bird. Harry was a sad case. Mistreated by people who didn't understand camels, he repaid unkindness by biting or worse. As Horrocks withdrew the charge with a ramrod, Harry lurched against him and the gun went off. Horrocks lost a finger to the ramrod and the ball entered his lower left jaw, knocking out his lower left molars. Gill bound his hand with a handkerchief, but gangrene set in and Horrocks died a month later. Before he died, Horrocks ordered that Harry be shot, not for revenge, but because he believed in camels and felt that Harry would give the whole species a bad name. I class explorers as pioneers or heroes or fools. But Horrocks was a bit of each, unlike George Grey, a double-dyed villain whose rashness should have killed him and did kill a teenage boy who was with him. David Carnegie, a younger son of an aristocrat, full of literary allusions and name-dropping, is by no means my favourite either. George Evans was a lovable hobbit of a man who couldn't spell, so Whitehall judged him unsuited to lead an expedition. He was both a pioneer, the first to actually cross the Blue Mountains and map the plains beyond, and a hero who lived largely off the land and harmed nobody. The key to success was finding water. Some looked for birds flying to water. Some were shown water by Aborigines, who then looked on horrified as the explorers' thirsty horses drank the source dry. Most of all, I enjoyed the accounts of ghastly water sources the explorers used, dank putrid holes that could only be forced to yield water by bailing them out with old boots. Details my very proper teachers would never have allowed us to read. If the water didn't kill them, falling from a mast, being trodden on or dragged by a horse, chased naked through muddy waters by a crocodile, shot by your own gun, drowned, bitten by a scorpion, poisoned plants, thirst and hunger all threatened them. Disorientation from scurvy, blindness from trachoma, and septic wounds also loomed as dangers. Leichhardt remains the big Australian mystery. He disappeared and no amount of searching could find any trace, but Ernest Giles had a theory about this. Sometimes a tropical storm can create a flood 50 miles wide in the desert, he said. He believed such a flood had buried Leichhardt and his party under metres of sediment, somewhere in the Lake Eyre catchment. There are no weather records from then, but it rings true. Step by step, I teased out the untold and little-known tales of the pioneers, the heroes and the fools, how they went out, why they went, what they did, and how they came back, all of it coming from their own accounts. With luck, a few textbook writers will take my tales and weave them into the mainstream narrative, but there are many more tales where they came from. The Hunt for Water is worth a book of its own. The best is yet untold, but it will be told, I hope, using methods like mine. We have the technology. But what of the format? My book was written, revised, edited, designed, proofed, and edited yet again to within an inch of its life. Yet we're told that books are useless, that we can get all we need from the internet. True, we can get the raw materials there. But like the poison cycad seeds that nearly killed Joseph Banks, some kitchen work needs to be done to make them palatable and nutritious. Far from killing the book, the new technology offers us new ways of making books live. But showing people how to do this demands a new form of information literacy. Fact-fossicking isn't easy. Clever fact-fossicking is downright hard. The vapid politicians who carry on about Australian history, meaning dead white male history, are also the ones who most commonly bleat about literacy, by which they mean simplistic reading and writing skills that can be tested. These enemies of education, with their foolish lists, are yesterday's men. True literacy bubbles and froths with joy, even when a dead political hand is placed on it, and the new literacy will, teachers willing, sweep their foolishness away. But who'll teach this new sort of literacy? Not the teachers of English, or computing, or science. They lack the skills and the time. Among the professionals of education, only one group can do it. Oddly enough, they're the very people most at threat from those who say the book is dead. Some call them school librarians, but they're really teacher librarians, people trained both as teachers and as librarians. Rather than getting rid of them and their libraries, we need to fund them better, far better. We need more, not fewer libraries, more, not fewer teacher librarians. I care about remembering and transmitting Australia's story. The explorers weren't the sort of people who learned lists of dates. They were people who questioned things and chased a brighter future. If Australia is to have a future worthy of the explorers, we must educate our young. Testing doesn't improve literacy, teaching does. And our teacher librarians sit at the heart of inspirational teaching. Politicians who don't understand that are selling our future short.
His book is called Australia's Pioneers, Heroes and Fools, and it's about our remarkable explorers. What really happened, not just the myth. Peter McInnes, Walking Wiki. Next week, another historian, but this one's a medic, Dr. Jim Leversley, on Abe Lincoln and 25 years, or 26 actually, of broadcasting on this program. I'm Robin Williams.